2019 was the driest year in Australia's recorded history. The drought has devastated towns and families across New South Wales and Queensland. Creeks have dried up, rivers have stopped flowing, dams are empty. In places like Eucarina in the central west of New South Wales, water has become so scarce they've had to truck it in from other places.
You need to wash your hair in that before you get out. I can't waste this water, Gurumali. There's not that much in it.
But this comes with a serious cost that many can't afford to pay.
We fill up our pots from this too to save water when we're cooking.
And for one family, the cost is not just financial, but spiritual and cultural too.
Last little bit, I can use that to cook dinner tonight.
Today, counting the human cost of the drought.
Love you, my big boy.
All fresh, Gurumali.
Love you, my son.
I'm Gabrielle Jackson.
What?
Can I please help you?
And this is The Full Story.
Yeah, so we went to Eucarina in December.
Graham Redfern is an environment reporter for Guardian Australia.
It's about an hour or so from Orange, also quite close to Dubbo. It's a small town called Wellington. It was very, very hot, really dry. It's agricultural country out there, but there's dust everywhere, dried up water holes pretty much wherever there is one. It's one road in, one road out. The houses are kind of on either side. Only maybe 100, 200 people living there. It's really remote.
Fleur, I'd like you to tell me who you're sat next to, please.
Okay. This is my beautiful husband. His name's Lockie, and I call him Gulier, which means our sweetheart in our language. And, yeah, he's the love of my life.
So we were there to meet Fleur and Lawrence.
I'm sitting here next to my beautiful wife, Fleur Naomi Magic Dennis, and she's my beautiful wife. I call her Gulier too. And she's my beautiful wife, and we've been married for over 6 years.
Everybody calls Lawrence Lockie, and they're an Aboriginal family. They've got four kids living in Eucarina.
The kitchen's pretty dodgy, but oh well.
Well, it's a lived-in kitchen.
The house is just on this tiny little road on the left-hand side. We pull up there.
Would you like to see the garden?
I'd love to.
Straight away, you can see the vegetable beds.
So we have, those are the few things we're keeping alive with water from the bath. So we've just got some oregano, some garlic chives. We've got some warrigal grass.
You see the rain tanks there in the front of the house. It's a pretty modest place with a beautiful family in it.
Yeah, so part of the appeal for us for moving here, out here in the bush, in the rural area where we're living, it's to teach our kids those values.
They moved to Eucarina because they were looking for a fresh start. They were trying to find somewhere where they were close and on country.
Without the outside influences of our people living in poverty due to systemic racism, our people living in harsh conditions with drugs and alcohol around them, the over-policing of our people. So our kids weren't subjected to that, so that they could be raised in a way that was strong culturally, spiritually, and ethically.
So the family moved to Eucarina in July 2017, and at that time, the place is gorgeous.
It was really, really nice here. Lovely, lovely and green. Three beautiful flowing creeks here locally that all join up down in our local bush reserve.
Everywhere's green. The creeks are running. And this looks like the perfect place for them.
A lot of local bird life and wildlife and plenty of water to play in for the children down at the creeks. So it was a really nice place to live, and we loved growing a lot of vegetables and living in a peaceful, quiet, rural environment.
So this house, it's a rental. I mean, Lockie and Fleur do what they can with it. They could still grow this their veggies in the gardens there. And when they move in, they've got plenty of water, so there's no issues. You know, they've got these veggie patches with all sorts growing in them. That was really important for Fleur and Lockie and for the kids to kind of show them where the food comes from.
We enjoy gardening and it's good to teach the kids. But we've had to let this die. It's been dead now for 2 years because of the town water supply drying up and the drought and the lack of rain. We haven't been able to water it. And so we've had to let it all die.
So, Graeme, can you tell us about Eucharina and how that town has been affected by drought?
It's a town that's relied on this tiny little private dam to supply sort of non-potable water for the whole community.
All around us, the local areas are also running out of water. So we know that Burrendong Dam is so low, it's almost run out.
The region's main water supply, which is Lake Burrendong, which is only sort of a 25-minute drive away, that is also almost empty. It's at 1.5%.
So how long has the drought been going?
Well, they moved there in July 2017, and that pretty much coincides with when the rain stopped. And from there on in, things got worse and worse. Within a year, the water supply that they had from the private dam that serves the town, that was turned off because there was almost nothing left. So then they're left with the absolute only option, which is to pay to have water carted in to then fill up their water tank.
Because at the moment we're just carting water by a local private water company that carts water in a truck. She brings 13,000 litres for us around every 18 days.
And they were doing that using their own money for, I think, about a year.
Wait, they had to pay out of their own money to have water trucked in when the dam was dry?
Yeah, there was almost nothing coming out of their taps. So they just had to find water, and that was the only way that they could get it. People would turn up with those big, heavy, blocky plastic water containers that they would use for drinking water. They paid for the water carting, as many other people in the town were. Because remember that the only place they could get non-potable water was from this dam that is now dry. And they were using the rainwater as their drinking water, but now they're relying on their rainwater tank, which has now got nothing left in it.
And, yeah, I'm just really concerned that this is not a sustainable solution to just have water trucked to us for ordinary household use and drinking. How could we truck water forever? And so I'm just really worried about our future at the moment.
At that point, that's when when she sort of really starts to get engaged, and the Little Towns Progress Association starts to write to Dubbo Council and say, we're in a crisis here.
Did they get any response?
They got some response eventually. Fleur went to the media in the end. She went to the local media and made a bit of a fuss. She'd written several letters at that point, as had the Progress Association. And then the council were then paying for the water to be carted in. So they still, the family still has to rely on carted water, but the council had accessed some funding to pay for that. It's based on an allowance of 100 litres per person per day. Now, that's already pretty tight. They can only use that inside the house. They can't use it for anything outside. But it's also difficult for the family because they work as mentors.
It's not just Fleur, myself and our four sons. We've got cultural obligations as well, where we have sometimes our house gets pretty full. Sometimes we have up to a dozen people in the house at a time. And a lot of those are little kids that we help mentor culturally and spiritually to in our Aboriginal cultural ways. And we do our best to facilitating those guys, but the thing is, water is one of those things that we use a lot of, especially when the weather's warm and we've got so many people in the house. So the 100 litres per day per person is we end up sharing that 100 litres with the people that we invite or sometimes come into our homes. And, you know, we're not the type of people that'll turn people away, especially if they're a visitor that's travelling, and 90% of the time we do get visitors that travel from Sydney out west, and we're sort of like a central location when it comes to our people travelling. And I'm not going to say to an elder or something like that, or somebody that's travelling that rings up and say, "Oh, we're coming through your way. Do you mind if we pull up for a cuppa, or do you mind if we pull up and have a rest?" I'm not going to say to them, "No, you'll just have to keep driving, because we haven't got enough water to support you." So that's not the way things are done.
It's not just the use of the water in the house either. I mean, the drought really it impacts the ability for them to sort of pass on knowledge.
So we are cultural knowledge holders and cultural leaders for our people, and that's why we have a big responsibility in terms of passing on our culture to the future generations of our people, the current generations and future generations. So when we share things like language and song and dance and ceremony, it's about sharing that in a context, and all of that information is connected to country, which includes water. So all the different water sources, and like whether it's a billabong, which we call billabong in our language, or whether it's a billa, a river, or a creek, Daran, all those different places are connected to our stories and our culture. And without country and without waterways, we can't have a culture. Our inability to take our kids down to the creek and show them how to gather the freshwater mussels and how to cook them up on the fire, the inability to show our kids how to gather the edible reed roots and what to eat, and then how to make sure that we sustainably manage those resources, the inability to show our kids how to fish for the guya, the fish in the water, and how to do things according to the local seasons, how to respect and honour the trees, and how we want to teach them how to gather our bush foods and other plants that grow in the area. At the moment, nothing's growing. Everything's dying. So we can't gather the different fibres for weaving. We can't gather the different edible seeds or fruits because nothing's fruiting. That can't happen anymore. It's part of passing on culture, but it's also part of our resilience and part of our survival, because when we share our bush tucker, we're keeping alive our culture and we're keeping alive our connection to country, and that's keeping alive our spiritual wellness.
Next, the unequal cost of drought. So listening to Fleur and Lawrence, this isn't just about, oh, I need more water for my garden, or I need more water to drink at home and to have more showers. For them, it seems to be about so much more. Is that right?
I mean, absolutely. So this issue of being able to get access to water, I mean, like nobody's lives exist in these sort of neat little pockets. So the water issue is sort of just part of a whole bunch of things that are going on for Fleur and Lawrence, and lots of other Aboriginal families too. I mean, it sort of really brings us into focus for some fairly systemic issues for Aboriginal people in Australia.
Racism has affected Aboriginal people since the invasion of this country in a big way. And racism is something that affects our people in an ongoing way on a daily basis. Our people had all of our land illegally taken from us. We have not been compensated for the loss of our land, which means that our people have had generational poverty since invasion. It's a factor that has arisen due to many generations of racism and poverty, where our people are generally living in certain areas of housing commission or low-income rental properties. And why is this connected to water? Well, all of it is connected, because the suffering of our people is that we're the lowest socioeconomic group in Australia, and now most of our people are the ones suffering from lack of daily household water and lack of recreational water, because we can't afford to pay for a pool, but there's no rivers left or no creeks left or no public dams left because they're all empty. Or we can't afford
to pay for water to our houses and we're not getting our basic household needs met, or in other Aboriginal communities, the water quality is really poor. If you've got resources at your disposal, such as capital with land or such as financial resources, you can make different choices about where you live or what other ability you can bring in to even move and shape the system to get them to answer to your needs. So basically in Australia right now, I see the communities that are most suffering with just their very basic needs, like drinking water, water for ordinary household use and water for basic recreational use. It's the Aboriginal communities and the poorest people in this country that are suffering the most. And I feel like sometimes that society in Australia sees the water needs of sheep and cattle even more important than actual human beings. My little son, who's 7, he said to me the other day, "Mum, when I grow up, I'd love to buy some land and grow bush tucker if we survive." And I said, "What do you mean if we survive?" And he said, "Well, if we survive climate change." And I was in a lot of shock over his comment. Even though he's only 7, he's aware that it's a survival issue at the moment. That he's just so worried about his future.
And it is. It's something that's worrying as a parent. You know, what's going to happen with our kids and our grandkids? You know, because with the way that the country is, like if a 7-year-old gets it, why can't a big supposed to be educated politician get it? You know, why can't he just toss aside the monetary factor and say, look, there's not going to be a future in this if we can't look after it? They can't see that this whole planet is not just a mine. It's not just a place to take from. Our Mother Earth has lived without us for thousands of years. Countless generations has lived for eons without us. And if we don't stand up and start looking after it, what's going to happen is she'll kill us all and then go on living without us. It may not be the beautiful place that we know of it, know it as today, but it will be another place. And we won't be a part of the equation. But the question that we need to ask ourselves as humans is, do we want to be a part of this? And if the answer to that question is yes, we need to pull our fingers out and start making change.
Well, I think the main concerning thing for me is that the people that are in charge are aware of this and they choose not to act. So I really don't think they care about the people that are in the bottom rung of the economic situation in the world. So there's no future in appealing to them. They're not going to change. They're not going to all of a sudden start sharing their wealth and allowing everybody else to have a fair decision-making power in how we go forward from here to protect our water and our earth. The only way that we can do that is working together as grassroots people who have a different vision in mind for how the world could be. And that's a really, really big job, to change the world so significantly that things could be more equitable. In recent years, things have gotten less and increasingly less and less and less and less equitable. And that's the whole issue with water, in terms of who gets water or who doesn't.
Yep. Fleur and Lockie, they were asked to go to a nearby town, Wellington, by a local pharmacist to do a rain dance.
All of you, thank you for coming, and thank you for asking us to come and dance in our Wiradjuri country today. Nadi yo and Namir, Baladu Wiradjuri Yinap, Baladu Murong Wiradjuri Nurumbanga, Baladu Ngamma, Bulabura Wuramindere. I said hello to you all. I'm Fleur. I'm a Wiradjuri woman.
We were there, and it was a real honour to be around them at that time and to witness that. They tried really hard to bring in everybody in the community to take part in the dance, and many of the locals in Wellington did.
Some from Eucarina, some from Orange, all come to dance here today. And hopefully we can do this again and include more and more of the young people each time. We would like to also invite, as part of this, we'll also invite people up to join us throughout the ceremony and the dance.
First one pays respects to our Mother Earth, our Father Creator, and our ancestors, Balambambu.
There was a moment where two Buddhists turned up to the dance, and you had the whole community standing around when the rain dance finishes, and hugs and handshakes, and, you know, a Buddhist monk hugging this Aboriginal family with all the white fellas looking on. It was a really beautiful gesture. So as well as Fleur and Lockie trying really hard to sustain their culture in this really stressful environment at home, you know, they didn't forget that they felt that they had responsibilities to everybody else, to do whatever they felt that they could to help it rain and to give people hope.
But since you've been there, we've had huge rainfall in parts of New South Wales. Did you, Karina, get any of that?
It appears that it's missed out. Dubbo, Orange also really didn't get very much. I don't think Wellington got very much. I mean, there may be more to come in the in the next few days, and let's hope that they get some drops of rain. We spent a few days in the town in Wellington, and it's the only thing that people are talking about. It's the only they just talk about water.
And Graham, have you spoken to Fleur and Lawrence since you've been back?
Yeah, I spoke to Fleur late last week. I mean, they've moved to Sydney now just because of this lack of water, this unreliable water supply. I mean, that's sad in itself, and that, again, it means they're moving off country. They'd actually bought this sort of rundown house only like 30 or 40 metres down the road from the rental place. They were trying to get out of this sort of cycle of rentals that they go through. I mean, the place needs a lot of work. We had a walk through. There's no floors or real ceilings. There's wires hanging out all over the place. They were trying to make it livable, but obviously, you know, affording renovations like that is hard. But then, you know, the water security issue in Eucarina. They need some infrastructure in the town. The council is waiting to drill a bore. The dam water supply is sort of irregular. It's not just a case of rain. So, you know, for now, Sydney it is.
Okay.
This episode of Full Story was produced by Ellen Leibeater, Joe Koning, and Jake Morecambe. Our executive producer is Miles Martignoni. Thanks also to Graham Redfern and to Rebecca Lever. I'm Gabrielle Jackson, filling in for Laura Murphy-Oates while she's on holiday. This story is part of our Frontline series on people living inside the climate crisis. You can find this story and many more at theguardian.com. Thanks for listening. If you listen on an app that has ratings or reviews, we'd love you to tell us what you think. That's it for today. See you on Wednesday.
Wonderful, nyara, 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 nyara,